This is Polly Young Eisendrath on March 11th, 2000. What Women Really Want. Tape 2 of 4.
We've been lucky in being able to relate to our exes and their exes and their new ones. And every Thanksgiving, we get the extended blended together at our house and have a big sort of big chill weekend where everyone spends about 4 days together with all of everybody. And even our children's ex-boyfriends and girlfriends are welcome to come. So,
this is a good example, this what Polly's just saying here, is one of the differences between Polly and myself. I would have never done this. And for years, I just dreaded it. Seeing my ex-wife, but you know, it has been a great thing. It really has, and I would have never done it without her. But just the effort, and the kids are all proud of it now. I'm proud of it. So I suppose the difference is that Polly will take risks at doing things that I would have never done without her. And some of these times, she just drags me kicking and screaming into them, and I've learned to trust that it's worth it. Going to Vermont, for instance, was her idea. I was against it. I was afraid of it. And it's worked out really quite well. So, anyway.
So, I mean, I think that what happened to me was I saw a movie by Fellini when I was in college called 8½. And at the end of the movie, he puts together all the people in his life and they have one big party.
Yeah.
And that's always been my ideal. So... every Thanksgiving, we put together everybody and have one big party, and it works out pretty well now. I mean, it's taken us all, we're all getting older, you know, and so it's taken us a while, really, to take the edges off of things. But so we particularly, Ed and I, like working with the blended family situation, and it has its own dynamics, and particularly the couple, which makes actually the pair that keeps the family together. And we won't be talking in a special way about that today, so if you have questions, feel free to ask us. So what I'm going to talk about this morning is this development from romance to disillusionment to intimacy in couple relationship. And I'm going to start by talking a little bit about love to say that, as I said last night, that love is often confused with romance, with desire, and with wishing. When people fall in love, they fall into a kind of idealizing projection. And that projection really is generally of something in themselves that they believe they see in the other person, some potential for development, some wish, or some desire. And over time, if the relationship becomes a committed relationship, and when we say committed these days, it doesn't necessarily mean marriage. Some people feel committed when they call themselves a couple. I mean, some young people feel anxiety when they call themselves a couple. And then for other people, it's when they move in together, and for other people, it's when they get married, and for some people, it's not until they have a child together that they actually feel this kind of anxiety. But as soon as you feel stuck with your partner, you're going to go into a different stage in the relationship. And that stage we call disillusionment. Other people call it power struggle. There are lots of names for the thing that happens when the romance is transformed into a kind of battleground. But what happens dynamically is that what was a positive projection now turns into a negative projection. And again, I'll come back to this. But still, you're not seeing your partner clearly. First, you see the partner through the lens of romance, and then through the lens of what would be usually a negative parental complex. And then, if you stay long enough, and you actually work to love this other person, which, as I mentioned last night, Octavio Paz, the poet, says that love is where desire meets reality. And so, if you can stay connected and committed to your partner through the time of the negative projections and begin to take back what you projected and integrate it and see what it means in your own life and begin to see the other, you will also come to see yourself. And during that transformation, then, you will come to this third stage of a relationship called intimacy. And intimacy is the ability to have a give and take and to value your partner as much as you value yourself, not more and not less, to see the other person as somebody that forms the base for your life, and to experience your relationship as the place that you live. And so, therefore, you don't want to pollute the place that you live, and you come to learn to have a kind of deep respect and practice that respect even in moments where you feel some of the most enormously powerful emotions that have to do with these complexes that can be triggered in the presence of a person that you feel stuck with. And because those were the experiences emotionally that you had as a child when you were stuck with people and you were powerless to do anything about it. And I will, again, come back to this. I'm just trying to give an overview. So this final stage of a couple relationship, I would really call love, where you actually come to regard this other person as your friend, your partner, a person that you value as much as yourself. And in a sense, this form of intimacy is like a deep, long-term friendship that includes sex and that includes fantasy and includes lots of things, but most of all has this feeling of respect, a deep kind of respect. You probably know that friendship is based on equality. And when people are friends, they have a kind of mutuality and reciprocity that's based on a trust. It's not the kind of reciprocity that says, if I did three things for you, you should do three things for me. That's not based on trust. Reciprocity based on trust is, I basically give to you with a sense of trust that you also will be giving to me. And we don't have a, what is it called, a market economy going between us. You know, last week I did these things for you, and so this week I expect, that's more in the disillusionment stage when people are getting into the chit lists and the market economy and so on. So coming to the place of love from the space of romance is difficult. And I want to say a little bit about the history of marriage, but do you want to add anything in that?
The only thing I thought would be fun would be to show that little clip from the Woody Allen movie and contrast that view of marriage to what you're just talking about.
You want to start out with that right now?
Do you think?
Just wait a couple minutes and then put it in. And where do you want to put the scene from The Fisher King? Do you want to put that at the point where I want to do it this,
yeah,
right before we get into the full lecture.
Okay.
But
we'll start with Woody Allen.
Okay.
Whenever,
okay,
you think it's right.
Good. I want to just say a little bit about the history of marriage, and then talk about the way that people regard marriage largely in our culture, and then we'll show this little clip from Husbands and Wives, a Woody Allen movie that came out a few years ago when his relationship with Mia Farrow was breaking down. It's just, I mean, the reason that I laugh about it is that Woody Allen puts out, you know, into the public whatever's going on in his life. And so, you know, you could sort of see what was happening in his relationship with Mia Farrow if you saw the few movies that came out during that period of time. Marriage as a sacrament existed before marriage existed as a social institution, as a legal institution. By the way, everything I'm talking about today is also included in the book called You're Not What I Expected, Love After the Romance Has Ended, which I believe is for sale today. The social institution of marriage came into being in around the 11th and 12th century. Marriage became legal, and last night I told the story of Sir Gawain and the Lady Ragnell, which was probably told in response. It was probably initially told among people as a folktale in response to the institutionalization of marriage, where women were required to give up their property and their rights to their husbands. Essentially, it was a way for paternal lineage to be protected. A paternal lineage is not clear. The maternal lineage in a family is clear, obviously, because women have the children. But the paternal lineage is not clear. And so men found a way to possess their children by giving their names to the children, and to possess their wives by giving their names to their wives. And then at that period of time when marriage became a social institution, women basically gave up their personal sovereignty to get married. Now, under those conditions in the Middle Ages, marriage was a business contract. It had nothing to do with romance. It was set up by families, arranged in advance of people meeting each other, often in the situations where families had a lot to protect, like a lot of property and wealth. Marriages were set up at the time of the birth of the child. There were arrangements made with other families. And if you know anything about the Middle Ages, there were, in the Middle Ages, a number of sex and love or romance, more like sex and romance manuals that were out, that were like our, you know, Dr. Ruth manuals. And so there was also in the Middle Ages a strong feeling for sex and romance, and it existed outside of marriage. Marriage was not the place to have romance. So people who wanted to develop the art of romance had paramours or lovers, and because the underlying condition for romantic love is leisure time, and you don't have that in marriage, which is a social business contract. So in the Middle Ages, people, you know, saw things a little differently than we see them. They didn't try to throw everything together. So on one hand, marriage then was a place where you had the business of continuing the lineage of a family, protecting its wealth and its property and so on. And then if you had the leisure and you had the freedom, you could go off and have romance with someone outside of the marriage. And there were instructions for doing that. And as I said, the underlying piece was leisure time. So as things developed over time, and Jung talks about this a little bit in Marriage as a Psychological Relationship, his essay, all of this got reorganized. And I can't sort of follow the whole history of it, but I'll try to bring it up to the 19th century when marriage began to very fully get associated with romance. What happened then was that instead of marriage being a function of family, it began to be a function of the individual. The idea of falling in love or choosing your mate is the notion that the individual can go out and choose somebody to be with over a long period of time, let's say a lifetime. Now, how is the individual equipped to do that? Well, not very well, actually, as we've come to find out. And to make romance the basis for marriage is a little crazy, actually. And what Jung saw was that when this shift took place, it gave people the possibility for individuation, for individual development in a way that they hadn't previously had, because now they were able to, through choosing a partner, to have a psychological ground in which to transform and develop, because they were going to choose the partner based on projection. And what they were going to project is the most idealized, you know, aspect of themselves, where they want to grow and develop, whether it's, I mean, these days it can be, you know, you pick somebody because you think that they have that promise of creativity or the promise of sexual enlivenment or the promise of money or whatever it is that you're looking for that you think would make your life a better place. You're going to look for that in a potential partner, and you're going to do it through projection. So falling in love is falling into the unconscious. And then if you marry, you're going to have the opportunity, as I said before, to take back these projections. So this situation in regard to romance being the basis for marriage is a relatively new thing. And it doesn't exist over large parts of the world. Arranged marriages still exist in large parts of the world. So then, in addition to that, what happened was really that people discovered that romance leads to disillusionment. And from about the 19th century into and through the 20th, people started to notice that marriage was a kind of battleground, like that romance would be one sort of story, but it didn't end in living happily ever after, but rather ended in something like a Cold War that would go on over decades, known as the Battle of the Sexes, usually. And so many of us grew up in households where our parents got married and they stayed together based on the same kind of a social contract that people in the Middle Ages did. You got married, you own property together, and you have children, and that's it. You stay together. Now, those conditions do not necessarily lead to love. They tend to lead to disillusionment and existing in some sort of arrangement whereby you have some kind of constrained conflict. Occasionally people would get lucky and they would actually have a good love relationship over time. But my sense from speaking to hundreds of people about this is that that's fairly rare in the generation of parents that are the post-World War II parents, or those people maybe even who were married during World War II. It's more likely to be the case that they fell in love, got married in the romance, and then went into disillusionment and stayed there for the rest of their lives. And so many of us have parents then who advocated staying together and being enemies. And we know what that feels like. And it was taken as ordinary everyday life and what's to be expected of marriage. Consequently, even now, in this period of time that I'm going to talk about in terms of the search for intimacy in marriage, but even now, the norms of our culture are that marriage is a battleground and that the sexes actually can't get along over time in a long-term committed relationship. That's the norm. That's the thing we see in the movies, that we read in the books, that we kind of expect. And so before I talk about intimacy, we're going to show Woody Allen's version of marriage, which is pretty much like what I was saying, that it's a long-term battleground. Woody Allen eventually believed that marriage itself destroyed the fabric of relationship and that the best you can do is to have a kind of serial romance in life, that that's the best. That kind of characterization of the problems of marriage are, it would be the typical characterization that most people in our society would tend to believe to be the case of marriage. It was about 25 years ago, with the advent of feminism, the possibility for a different kind of long-term relationship between a man and a woman became more of a reality. And this type of relationship would be a relationship of friendship or equality. Until feminism had an effect, a large effect on culture, men and women were in some version of the medieval marriage. That is, the woman took the man's name, and she basically kind of came under his roof. And in some way or another, as I talked about last night, she had to make power arrangements. She could be the little red hen, or she could be the object of desire, but she couldn't really be an equal partner for a variety of reasons. So about 25 or 30 years ago, feminism comes into our society, especially in a different way than it ever had entered in before. Women go on the cultural record. They start speaking about their own experiences. They start actually feeling that they have experiences that are their own. And women start to have a voice in culture that allows a different kind of relationship to emerge. And this relationship, this form of relationship, most people would refer to as an intimate relationship. And within about the last 20 years, it's the number one reason why people get married, is to have an intimate relationship. Prior to then, the number one reasons would be having children, sharing a lifetime history, those kinds of things. People weren't looking for an intimate relationship. I know my parents had nothing like an intimate relationship, but when I got divorced from my first husband, I was, my parents were Catholic, and so this was a great violation. I don't think anyone in the family had ever been divorced before. So with some trepidation and having, you know, been a kind of hippie and that type anyway, I was into, I think, having the sense of breaking norms. But with trepidation, I went to my mother. I hadn't told her there were problems in the marriage even. And I tried to say why I was divorcing my first husband, who was my professor in college and many years older than me, and I was his third wife. And my parents didn't like him at all, and they didn't like the conditions under which I married him. And yet, when I was coming and saying, well, we're going to be divorced, and my mother said, well, why would you get divorced? And I said, well, the relationship actually is not a good relationship. And my mother said, and I'm quoting her, a relationship? This isn't a relationship. You're married to him. And she said, in a marriage, you just move to the other bedroom. It's not a relationship. So, you know, she couldn't even understand my language. And she had, of course, sacrificed, in her words, sacrificed everything in her life for me, her only child, and stayed married to this ogre that she, you know, believed was my father, and had been tortured every day of her life. And now I was going to walk away from somebody because I didn't have a good relationship. So the idea of intimacy in a marriage is a relatively new invention, and people put it number one on their list. More divorces now come about because people are disappointed in the relationship than come about for any other reason. So in this relatively brief period of time, we've put together romance and marriage and then tried to get intimacy out of marriage, which it wasn't designed for in the first place. So you can see that these conditions all make it very understandable why when people come to psychotherapy where they have problems with their marriage, they express a lot of hate. You know, they weren't expecting things to be quite this difficult, but things are really quite difficult in terms of the movement from disillusionment to intimacy. So what is this intimacy? It's really, as I said, it's the ability to have a long-term friendship and to take back the stuff that you've projected. Both the idealizing projections that this person is going to bring you some things that you cannot bring yourself, and the devaluing projections that this person is actually worse company than the goldfish, you know, that you would rather spend time with anybody other than this person who causes you so much grief. So I'm going to talk a little bit about psychological complexes, archetypes, and projection. But before I do that, I think I'm going to say, do you have any questions or anything, things that you would ask, maybe more for clarification here about what we've been talking about so far? First of all, I want to say that I take this definition from Harry Stack Sullivan, who's an American psychiatrist, and he defined intimacy specifically as the relationship of mutuality, reciprocity, and trust that is based on a give and take where you value the other person as much as you value yourself, not more, not less. And that was the definition he gave for deep friendship. And he saw that also as a potential between the sexes. When you do, you take back the projections, there are positive and negative projections. Generally, the positive ones are the ones that require you to take responsibility for development in your own life, and the negative ones are the ones that require you to begin to look at what happened to you in your childhood and why you're so triggered under some circumstances and how you are yourself responsible for your own emotional responses. The other person doesn't make you feel that way, but you actually have an emotional trigger that gets triggered, and you feel that way because you've already felt that way. That's kind of the... Individuation? Yeah. And I haven't actually said what individuation is. So maybe actually I'll use this as an opportunity just to review that. This is a Jungian term, and there are different definitions of individual. You must have noticed if you read Jung that he's not systematic in his thinking, you know, so he defines things differently on at different times and on different pages. But the way that I understand individuation, I take a kind of, what I would say is almost a classical Jungian view of this, is that it's the capacity for becoming a psychological individual. And what that means is the ability to recognize a variety of subjective states in yourself as aspects of a personality that you may not be consciously aware of all of the time, so that things fall outside of your control and outside of your awareness, and that they still are your responsibility, that you have, as a personality, to use the Jungian terminology, complexes that are non-ego, that are not a part of the conscious, aware personality, and that they are still your responsibility. When you come to know those not-ego complexes, you will find that you are both more complicated and more interesting than you thought, perhaps, and that you know, you're working with yourself is like a little bit like working with a multiple personality. It's like working with a group, that you have parts and beings in there that you hadn't thought you had. And some of them actually might be better than you thought you were, and others are a lot worse than you thought you were. And as you become able to be aware of these multiple centers of subjectivity and work with those in a way that's responsible and respectful of others, you become a psychological individual, and you have a way of being that's different from a person who is not a psychological individual, but basically lives out the complexes of childhood unconsciously and enacts them on other people. And most of us grew up with parents who did that. And so, again, that's not uncommon. It's not in any way uncommon to be an unconscious human being. That is the norm. And that's what we're dealing with most of the time, most every place we are. The possibilities for becoming a psychological individual are relatively new in the history of the human race. Before, they belonged to the rare individual, the poet, the spiritual master, the artist, or whatever. But only in this recent period of time have they become possible, have these ways of development become possible for regular people, and in part because of the shift in marriage. And Jung talks about this particularly in Marriage as a Psychological Relationship. He uses sometimes such esoteric language that it's hard to unpack it, but what I've just said is really what he's talking about there when he talks about endogamous and exogamous marriage within the family or outside of the family and so on. So this possibility for individuation is closely related to marriage as it's developed in the 19th and 20th century. So is all that pretty clear? It makes sense. And
with regard to your question about intimacy is very hard, in my experience, to define, because it's a little like happiness. It's a byproduct of certain conditions, and that it's easier to describe the conditions that are necessary to exist in order for intimacy to emerge. And one of the conditions, one of the ways in which you feel intimate in a marriage, is when you solve problems together. When you have these ground kind of thing that Polly was describing, of the equality and mutuality, it's sort of like, in order to have it, you have to do the things that I'm talking about in order to get it, so it's all mixed together. But when you have problems, and this is what we'll talk about in the afternoon with the dialogue therapy and show you some videotapes, they're your greatest opportunities to build trust and intimacy. So these problems, these differences, these difficulties or conflicts are the greatest opportunities to grow, as you probably know that. Now, the way you handle these things and the way you talk about them and the respect you use in talking about difficult, potentially hurtful topics create trust and create a feeling of intimacy, a feeling of you can relax with this person. This person isn't going to hurt you when they get upset, isn't going to turn on you. This person sees you. All of the sort of a complicated set of things that take place, and that feeling of intimacy emerges out of these kinds of interactions.
And actually, one thing that makes it so difficult, so challenging, is that in order to become comfortable with this person, you have to learn to contain yourself. And you can only actually ever deal with yourself as somebody that you're responsible for. You're not responsible for this person. So ultimately, it has to be the case that no matter what the other person does to you, you can rely on yourself to get to that point of respect, friendship, intimacy, to get back there. Because in a couple relationship, like other kinds of relationship, it's a system that is interactive. So if one person changes, the system changes. So both people don't have to reach this sort of place of psychological awareness. Only one does in any given moment. Because if that one reaches it, then the other person can come along with it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
About what Scott Peck says about love, that love is not a feeling, that love is an attitude or a frame of reference, it's not a feeling. Because that feeling, the warm feeling of affection for the other person, may or may not be there at any particular moment. That's really a big question. And you're speaking from a Buddhist perspective of enlightenment and a Jungian perspective of... it's just so difficult because there's so many qualifiers. I'll try to say something briefly. Okay, a supreme enlightenment, like the enlightenment of Shakyamuni Buddha supposedly was, probably means a complete individuation. But that's so rare that most people that any of us will ever know will be, have had enlightenment experiences which are not total and complete, and so will be only, you might say, partly enlightened or only enlightened in regard to certain things. And there may still be elements of that individual's personality that are not individuated or evolved. And in, let's say, the worst-case scenario, which I have known in my own experience, you can have individuals who are really quite adept at spiritual practice and have had maybe even repeated enlightenment experiences, but have no psychological awareness of their personalities, and so they still can enact things that are based on what I would say from a Buddhist perspective, their karma, their birth karma, that they haven't come to terms with. And so you can have, for example, a Zen master who has really achieved a great deal spiritually, but also has sexually abused, for example, a student. And I don't think that that's a kind of a totally rare situation. So the case of the supremely enlightened individual is so rare, and we. You know, if there, supposedly, according to some Tibetan teachers, there are supremely enlightened people who are alive now on the earth, but most of them live in remote caves, and they're not married, and they're not working with a sangha, we don't see them, mostly. They're not in the fire, and I don't know them, and I've never met them, and so I could only say theoretically they might be very evolved, but the people that I know and that I meet, they need sort of the psychological as well as the spiritual. And the paper that's on transference and transformation is specifically deals with the Zen master student or master disciple situation in relation to what it's like to be a therapist with a patient. And there's transference in both relationships. And my sense is that in the West, what we may bring to Buddhism is some psychological awareness of some of the issues that have to do with relationship and so on, which I think could be helpful. Okay. So let's go back to complex and archetype and all of that. And how are you doing? Let's see. It's about 11:05. We started a little bit after 10. Do you think you could sort of spend another 20 minutes or so and then take a break and then have some discussion? The thing that I like to introduce here about archetype and complex is the idea that there are actually three Jungian schools that are alive and well. And if you are interested in this sort of thing, the Cambridge Companion to Jung, which I edited with Terence Dawson, is a book that is a very good resource for seeing these three different approaches to Jung's psychology, and I'll name them and say where they originated. And it also takes a case, a single case, and looks at it from the perspective of these three schools, both theoretically and clinically. So you get the whole drawn-out picture. All right, there's the classical Jungian school, which originated in Zurich and is connected to Jung's work and also the people who surrounded Jung. There's the developmental school, which originated in London and is connected to Michael Fordham and the Tavistock. And the developmental school, which is really my orientation, is also related to object relations theory because it grew up at the Tavistock where object relations theory started, or was really developed anyway. And the third school is the archetypal, which is associated not with a place but a person named Jim Hillman. And I can't say I completely understand this school, but in the Cambridge Companion, Michael Vannoy Adams writes very well about it. The thing about the archetypal school is it tends to kind of get boiled down to Hillman. It really isn't just James Hillman. It's a group of people who reacted to ego psychology in psychoanalysis and the classical Jungian theory on the Jungian side, and they established what would be called a via negativa. They reacted negatively to a number of things, and in their reactions, they established something that is supposedly a thing in itself that has its own approach. I sometimes think it's still mostly a via negativa, but it does have a way of looking at imaginal material, image and symbol in its own way. So these three schools are all alive and well and living in the Jungian world, and they all have their followers. Most people who function in the classical Jungian approach will be, and I'm going to just use this term if you know it, they're going to be essentialist. They're going to think in terms of categories that exist universally and are in themselves essences. They're going to talk about the masculine and the feminine. They're going to talk about the self and the animus and the shadow and so on. Now, I won't go into that in detail. It is an approach that I understand quite well, and it's one that myself I would reject. I don't see it as sort of coherent in this period of time as we have become. We've started to think very differently in terms of relativity, both from a scientific point of view in terms of relativity from a philosophical point of view, that we tend to now sort of regard reality as something that is in process, that it is not a thing in itself. And there's just many more things to be said about that, but I'll try not to say them. And so the classical school tends to rest on essentialism, and many people, and particularly many Freudians, regard the whole Jungian bit as being essentialist and as having this kind of sort of reading out of all reality, almost like a catalog. You know, if it's this symbol, then it means that. And to me, this is a very much of a negative boiling down of what the Jungian world is like. The classical Freudians, they have their reading. They have their sort of recipe book. You know, if it's a cigar, then it's, you know, or if it's a cave, then it's this. So anyway, those are probably the negative readings that the Jungians make of the classical Freudians, as well as the classical Freudians making negative readings of Jungians. This is all more or less a thing of the past because, you know, the Jungians and the Freudians and the Sullivanians and the object relations, we all have a common enemy now, which is managed care. And so we've gotten together and, as a friend of mine said, we've all been stranded on the same small island. We have to talk to each other now, where we didn't for a long time. So we're all talking to each other. So the developmental approach, which actually has a lot of things in common with object relations theory, if you know this type of language, is the approach that I'm going to speak from right now. And I would say that it begins in Jung's work after about 1944 with his redefinition of the idea of archetype and his reorganization of his own theory of the unconscious, which is rarely, again, fully articulated by Jungian analysts, many Jungian analysts also, they're not reading Jung carefully, they're not thinking about the history of the theory, they're just using whatever they've got, and so they don't say, well, Jung actually changed his theory in 1944. He did, but he didn't systematize it. But he defined the archetype as a predisposition to form an emotionally charged image in a state of kind of emotional intensity. So the archetype is no longer an imago or an image, but rather a predisposition to form an image. And he saw it as similar to an innate releasing mechanism, which was a kind of popular term at that period of time in the 50s. And basically then, universally, human beings have, archetype means, you know, universal imprint. Universally, human beings are hardwired in such a way that they're predisposed to form emotionally charged images that are coherent. And they form those images in particular relational, he called them relational situations, you might call them relational contexts. And now we know from research on the emotional brain. In fact, I strongly recommend, if you're interested in this, a book called The Emotional Brain by Joseph Ledoux. Actually, the other book is Emotional Intelligence that's out there, which is, again, uses some of the same information, but the book The Emotional Brain is a little bit better review of the scientific material. Ledoux, L-E-D-O-U-X, Joseph Ledoux. A really good defense of archetype and complex. Not that he knows he's defending it, but I'll try to say it simply, that we know that emotional memory has two different forms in human beings. One is a representational form, which is associated with the hippocampus formation in the brain, and it's used kind of loosely. That is, we don't have exact memories of the past, but rather kind of categories that we use to reconstruct an image in the present. And so, you know, the experience you're having today, let's say you go home and you have an experience with your partner and it triggers some emotional memory in yourself. At that moment, you may see your partner as a very aggressive and kind of nasty person, and you actually perceive the image of this person to look and smell and sort of feel a lot like your father when your father got angry. So you don't remember, oh, father looks like this and husband looks like that, but you fuse the two together and they look the same to you. So this hippocampus formation, also we kind of tell the story of the past in a new way depending on the present, you know. Suddenly people recover memories. If those memories are colored by the present as well, we don't have the capacity to remember the past as a clean video of what happened. So this hippocampus formation has to do with representational memory, the way we represent in images. And then the other part of the old brain that's associated with emotional memory, which is the triggering of the system, is associated with the amygdala, and this kind of trigger that reacts, and so that people can react emotionally without even perceiving the stimulus that's making them react. The example that's often given is that human beings probably couldn't take the time when they were living out in the forests and the fields to decide whether this is a poisonous snake or not. So when they would see snake, they would just react with fear as though that snake were poisonous and run from it. And it's the same thing in your life. When you've experienced a poisonous snake in your early family situation, when you encounter some kind of stimuli that look like or sound like or smell like that snake, you're not going to discriminate. Is this the same kind of situation I was in before? You're going to react to it as though it were. That's the more, let's say, survival-oriented way of being. So, you grew up in an environment that was full of, let's say, sort of withdrawal and emotional sort of coldness, and you tried as an infant, and we know now that infants will do this, to cheer up your mother, and so your spouse now looks a little blue, and you're going to start to feel responsible for that person's unhappiness, because it was a thing that you did. You reacted by cheering up and wanting to see mother smile, and now you're going to do the same kind of thing with a spouse. And in a sense then, if we follow this little trend that I'm talking about, you'll start to feel responsible for your spouse's unhappiness, and you will want in some way for that other person to be happy, which is not your business, you know.
Just one more reminder, tomorrow's workshop with Polly and Ed will be over at the Good Shepherd Center at 10 in the morning, and you can register now at the table in the rear of the room. We'd encourage you, simply so we know that we can be able to accommodate everyone. Thank you.
Just for couples.
Oh, yes. And although it is titled for couples, it is not just for couples. Certainly everyone is welcome.
Okay, oops, excuse me. I also want to let you know that I will be here in Seattle until Wednesday morning, and while I will be teaching tomorrow and Sunday, I'll be available for individual consultation, at least some consultations, on Monday and part of Tuesday. So if you're interested, if anyone would be interested in coming either for a supervisory type of consultation or for just an individual consultation, I would be available to do that on some hours on Monday and some hours on Tuesday. So if you're interested, come and see me after this discussion. Also, I have a website, which is www.youngeisendrath, all small, all lowercase letters with the hyphen, .com. And I have an email address, and I would be happy to answer substantive questions over email, because I do use it as a way of teaching and also interacting with people who are interested in the topics that I'm interested in. And the email address is pye@together.net. So that's the other way to reach me easily. pye@together.net, which is the Vermont email. Yeah. The website is www. I'll just do it under my name. It's easier. Young Eisendrath with the hyphen, .com. And that the email, the website says, It gives you the possibility of ordering books, and it also says what my lectures are, what the upcoming lectures will be, and the workshops, and so on. Lucretia? this. There may be some women who, there are women who come here, this is a women's shelter, this room, and there may be women coming in at around 9:30, and I didn't know that when we started out, but I guess they'll be surprised to see us. But we will still be here for a while. So in case women begin coming in, they're supposed to be here. Now, I just want to say a few concluding things just to kind of put the final touches on the issues that surround autonomy, because, again, I think it's these things are often really confusing, especially, I think, with women and girls in relation to our roles. So I know from my own life and from the clinical work that I do that we become deeply ethical people only through the lessons of self-determination. And this is one of the reasons why I talk about the spiritual problem of giving yourself away. By freely engaging in our own choices and then seeing how and why these choices are flawed and lacking, we develop a sincere tolerance for our own and others' faults and a generosity in wanting to help. Struggling to use our conscious intentions to guide our actions, seeing how hard it is not to be driven by our complexes and our meaner desires, we develop compassion for others and ourselves. Over time, these challenges teach us. And here is how Jung puts it in a letter that he wrote. This is what Jung says, the apparently unendurable conflict is proof of the rightness of your life. A life without inner contradiction is either only half a life or else a life in the beyond, which is destined only for angels. But God loves human beings more than the angels. So we become true subjects of our own desires when we learn neither how to control others nor how to get things our own way. Rather, we learn what it means as a subject of our own desires. We learn what it means to be human, to be weak and conflicted, and most of all, dependent on others whom we need and whom we sustain. Personal sovereignty leads to the knowledge of freedom and the knowledge of limitation. On one hand, we come to consider our own desires and needs more openly, to take them as seriously as we would take those of others, of our friends, children, partners. We learn to negotiate differences and conflicts among our various commitments to community, family, and self, as well as differences and conflicts with others' needs and desires. On the other hand, we learn to recognize our mistakes, our weaknesses, our failures, and our limitations. As women, we learn especially, no matter how self-determining and honest we are, that we continue to live in a world in which images of the desire-awakening maiden still symbolize an almost transcendent vitality. We learn that our own claims to authority and desire, even when spoken calmly without blame, can be unfairly labeled as the expressions of a hag bitch whose emotions are deeply threatening. And under these conditions, we are not free in the sense of being more independent or more individual. We are free in the way of understanding human intentions and actions, our own and others. This increases our desire and skill in opening our hearts and becoming more authentic. For if wanting to be wanted is about image, wanting to be loved is about heart. To be loved is to be known and accepted without hiding in shame and doubt. The heart of wanting to be loved is a mature dependence, a way of living that rests on honesty, directness, transparency, and a give and take with others. For when we live as subjects of our own desires, we discover that we are sustained by others, paradoxically through making our own choices every step of the way. So those are the concluding, finishing touches to the idea that there's a paradox in autonomy that has to do with discovering your limitation. So, questions? tomorrow, she's asking about tomorrow's workshop in relation to couple relationship. We'll start out by talking about love and the issues that revolve around love and how and what love is in a couple relationship. I think the workshop is called Love After the Romance Has Ended. And love is very frequently confused with romance, wish, and desire. And then we will talk about how and why love is difficult, but only possible between equals, because love in a long-term partnership is friendship, and friendship occurs when there are equals. And then we'll talk about all the barriers that get in the way of that with couples, and then about how to solve some of those things. We'll use some movie clips. We will use some videos of Ed and myself, Ed Epstein, my husband, and I doing couples therapy together. And we'll try to deal with what we find in the group as well. So the tie-in is mostly around the issue of love.
What are the elements that make the hectic so special?
Well, I think really it's the implication that a woman's desire will lead to some kind of domination or subjugation, probably originally of men, you know, the notions that sort of lie behind the witch, the hag, or the bitch as an archetypal figure have to do with her domination of children and men in her image. That she sucks out the vitality and the life. So my sense is that the whole notion of a dominating woman is a way of keeping female power down, and so that it was invented essentially to keep female power down. There's a lot that's been written about the image of the witch and the bitch in myth and fairy tale, but also in culture. And I guess the most important thing that I think is that I'm going to put it in the terms of a French feminist, and so it's very obscure, but I'll try to say what that means. She basically says, if women are imagined to be empty of everything, if they're imagined simply to be in appearance empty of everything, then they are imagined to want to control everything. And so if you see women this way, and in the book I talk about the Pandora story, and Pandora is the first woman in Greek mythology, and she stands behind the issue of woman in Western culture. And she's invented to be beautiful but empty. She has no heart. And she's designed that way specifically. Hermes puts lies and flattery in place of a heart. So if you imagine woman to be empty of everything, then she must want to take control of everything. And so that's the hag bitch. She wants to dominate and take life away. So I feel like it's probably, ultimately, a commentary on female power, the reason why she's so threatening. But, you know, if you imagine woman differently, if you imagine her as an equal and a partner and a friend... Sir Gawain, yes. If you imagine her as an equal and a partner, as a friend, and a friend, then her emotional power is not threatening. It's just the same as yours. Yes. Oh, wow. Like, there are volumes written on that. I will say that the AAUW published their findings in a book called Shortchanging America. And it's about the education of girls and boys in America. Also, Reviving Ophelia is a kind of popular book on this issue. Basically, what happens is that overall, girls are encouraged to identify with their appearances by the culture. At the same time, it's really difficult to explain it all. But let me try to say along the lines that I've been talking about. Those girls who are going to identify with the main thing the culture is offering them will be in some way identified with being the muse. So they will want to be pretty, nice, popular, and whatever else has to do with... At this point, by the way, our muse is an anorectic, sort of empty-eyed waif. And that's the muse that America puts out for the entire world. So the girls all over the world are really trying to epitomize this particular image. But if you're going to go that direction, then you're going to, as a girl, tend to become competitive with other girls. And all of this gets organized around popularity and prettiness. If you cannot identify with the muse because either you don't think you look good enough or you fall ethnically outside of the possibilities for the muse, you will tend to identify yourself with being a bitch in the sense that girls who think of themselves as having kind of girl power in the sense of being able to say directly what they think also do not believe that they're going to be successes in life. They believe that they will continue to be marginalized. So you get this split in girls that starts between 11 and 13, and there are a lot of reasons why this gets going, where some girls are going to identify with the cultural norms, which will tend to lead them in the direction of becoming objects. And there are other girls who will identify with being subjects, but they will tend to think they're going to be marginalized. And so you don't have nearly as many girls thinking of themselves as seriously being able to be self-determining and knowing that they can be successful. There's a kind of split. And there are a lot of reasons why this takes place, but it's really pretty widespread. And so what happens is those girls that end up going to college... Now, some of the big studies of eating disorders in colleges now show that eating disorders are normative in colleges, like up to 60-some percent of girls who are in college have some disordered form of eating. And they know that, and they even kind of envy each other's, bulimia and so on. So those girls who will go to college, many of them are troubled by this kind of image of the muse. So that's the best answer I can give you. There are actually lots of readings out there, and I won't go on with it because I could. Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, in a way, you're probably asking the wrong person that question because I actually brought with me a paper called Suffering from Biobabble. And I think that we're in a period of time where we're talking about this genetics and biological stuff when we don't really know what's going on. What we actually do know about all of the things that have to do with being an object of desire, which have to do with indirect arrangements for power, indirect speech, and so on, tend to be associated with oppression if you look across cultures in many situations that not only have to do with gender but other things as well. And so myself, I have no reason to think that this gives us any kind of genetic advantage, but nor would I think that it makes any sense to think in those terms at all. I will try to hold myself back from saying how detrimental, and with lots of detail, how detrimental I think this type of ideology is to our ability to become intentional human beings. this thinking that we have genetic and biochemical stuff. And I teach in a department of psychiatry that's very biological, and I've seen the detriments, enormous detriments of that. So, no, I don't actually think in those terms at all. And I wouldn't even think it would be possible to investigate it until men and women are equal the world over. So, did you want to ask something else about it, though? Yeah. Well, you know, one person I didn't talk about was Princess Diana, and I talk about her quite a bit in the book. Because women often confuse wanting to be loved with wanting to be wanted. They think they will be loved if they take on these appearances. But the fact is they won't, because they won't be known. And Princess Diana was a really good example, because she chose lovers who didn't know her and didn't want her as a person. They wanted her for what she represented as an image. And that was so obvious to the rest of the world, you know, starting with Prince Charles. As Gloria Steinem says, what Princess Diana teaches us is never marry a prince, you know. So I do think that what happens is there's such confusion with, you know, among women between wanting to be loved and wanting to be wanted, that they think they're going to be loved. And of course, everyone wants to be loved. We really want to be loved. And I would say, you know, we're born into a situation where we're designed specifically for love, and but it's not being wanted. So, you know, that's where I think that why it's so powerful is that you believe that someone is going to love you for this. But it doesn't work out that way. Yeah. Well, what do you think the thinking is? See, if I think that the thinking is he'll leave me if I pressure him is exactly the thinking that I have some power that is going to be seen or experienced in a negative way. And if I think I don't have that power, then I'm just a human being like he is. And if I say to him, look, I want to be in a committed relationship, and so, will you commit or not? That's not pressure. That's just a question. There's no pressure there. Not one person has more power than the other person. It's just a direct question of, I want to be in a committed relationship. Will you commit to me or not? And so it's being direct about things. To allow that to remain in ambiguity is an arrangement whereby somebody is trying to get some kind of power over somebody else, and there's not an agreement about what's going on. So I don't know if that's, you know, if you can see that, but there's a buried assumption that you think you're going to pressure somebody by asking them a question. Do what? Yeah. Right. Well, I think actually that's really the basic way to live, is with that agency. Because without it, you're not free. You're not living intentionally. You're not living as your own person. But it doesn't create any extra pressure for anybody. It's just the condition in which you're living. But see, that's the assumption that what you're doing is making the assumption that the woman has some kind of negative power in just stating her desire, or in saying what her bottom line is, or in making it clear what she wants. You know, if... Well, see, that's the projection of the hag complex. And if you assume that the man thinks that if you state your needs directly, he's going to see you in this negative way, then you project into him something that says he's inferior, he's smaller than you are, he's sort of something less than you are, so he's going to see you as bigger. Actually, when I talk with men, when I'm with men in therapy and so on, most of the men that I'm dealing with who are trying to become psychologically aware are really happy when women are self-determining. They're really happy to hear directly what the woman wants so they don't have to guess. Because the guessing is actually hard. You know, well, do you want this or that? But if the woman says, this is what I want, then the man knows. And he can respond to that. Well, if a man is not able to handle an honest relationship, would you want to be in one? I mean, you know, would you want to be in one with him? But I mean, for any woman, if he can't handle an honest relationship, then, you know, do you want to be in relationship with a person? I actually think women underestimate men in saying, you know, in assuming the kind of hag bitch identity. Women who have learned to feel ashamed of their desires, I think, often underestimate their male partners. And that if they do speak directly, they may find that their partners rise to the occasion. And if they don't rise to the occasion, they may find that this wasn't a very good friendship anyway. You know, that it really didn't have the basis of equality. We should stop soon, because people are coming. 7 minutes. 7 minutes. Thank you. Yes. Oh, okay. Well, it's a complicated question, but let me try to answer. First of all, the idea of becoming a subject of your own desires has nothing to do with being a man. It just means being a woman who speaks directly. However, you know, women, many people do get confused about this. In one of the talks that I gave, I spoke to an audience where there was a woman who was, I guess she no longer is, an officer in the Navy. And she talked about the double bind that she encountered with her superior officer, who constantly marked her down for being indirect. As soon as she became more direct, he confronted her about being a bitch. And she said this double bind was almost impossible in the Navy. It had nothing to do with her acting like a man, but simply fulfilling her role as she was an officer, she was a commanding officer. So usually the dynamic is around this issue. If you're self-determining, someone is going to see you as a bitch. And so just knowing that means it's nothing about you personally. And so you need to be able to walk through that, just like Ragnell does. She walks right through it. She just keeps speaking from her heart. She keeps saying what she wants. And she doesn't either blame other people or shame herself. So it's the whole issue about how to take this on is really not to try to take it on as a role, but to take it on from the point of view of checking in with yourself about what you do want and coming back to the idea that you are responsible for your life and that you need to become self-determining. It really is checking with that resentment meter also. The good path, right. Right. Well, right. I'm not sure, because if you look at the literature on teenage girls, if you're talking about teenage girls, what you see, and there's a really good book by Lynn Michaels Brown, Carol Gilligan's associate at Harvard, called Raising Their Voices, I think. It's Teenage Girls and Their Expression of Anger. And what she finds in her studies are these two things that I described earlier. Either girls identifying with the norms, which have to do with being pretty popular and nice and so on, or they identify themselves negatively, but they don't think they're going to go forward in life. So she doesn't talk about girls who identify with being male. She talks really, she sees, and this is in interviewing girls themselves and the way they talk about themselves. My sense is that in the Jungian world, the animus-identified woman actually is a way of demeaning women. That label is a way of demeaning women, because the women who might be speaking in that framework of trying to take their own positions or state their own point of view often are labeled animus-identifying because the individual doesn't want to say bitch. You know, because there's it means the same thing, but they're being polite. So I don't see that really as a kind of exceptional thing. And I've written a lot about animus, and I've certainly been called an animus, a possessed woman or whatever. I guess what I would say, you know, to girls and to women and to everyone is be willing to walk through difficult territory to claim your own self-determination, because there is nothing that is so important as living as an intentional human being that allows you, from a Buddhist perspective, to live in a human realm where you can actually change your karma. All of the other realms, from the Buddhist perspective, where the beings live there, they cannot change their karma because they can't change their actions through their own intentions. So to be responsible for your intentions and your actions is at the very essence of being human. And so don't be afraid to take it on, even if people don't think you look good doing it, or you don't sound right, or your neighbor doesn't like it, or whatever. Try to stay on that path. Gradually, your heart will open. It just happens. It's absolutely the case. And men saw this a long time ago, you know. Women were really never meant to be fully enfranchised in patriarchy. So we weren't really meant to be admitted to the category of full human being. We're here, so we need to recognize what it means. So thank you very much. Thank you. And feel free to come up if you want to ask me something or want me to sign a book or something like that. So I think that's the business part for today. There's one other little business piece before we get started. Last night I mentioned to some people that, or maybe I mentioned it once in the group, that I brought with me some papers that could be made available to people. And what I'm going to do, I'm going to describe these papers briefly. I'm going to send them around. They're numbered, and there's a sign-up sheet that also allows you to put the numbers of the papers that you're interested in receiving. And so you should put your name and your address and the numbers of the papers. And then Diane, I guess, has kindly agreed to organize this, and you will be charged for the Xeroxing and the mailing. These are the papers. The first paper is a paper that's been written for a collection on psychology and Buddhism. It's actually a collection on community psychology and Buddhism. And the paper is called Suffering from Biobabble, Searching for a Science of Subjectivity. And it's about the problem of reductionism, the way that we tend to speak in what I call this chapter of our collective myth, which is the chapter on genetics. And the way we talk about our own behavior, our intentions and our actions in terms of biochemistry and genetics and the problems that that creates for people when they're trying to understand themselves or take responsibility for themselves. So that's the first one. The second paper is called Transference and Transformation in Buddhism and Psychoanalysis. And this is written from a Jungian perspective. It's also going to be published in a book that the American Psychological Association is putting out on Buddhism and psychoanalysis. And it deals with transference and transformation in Buddhism and psychoanalysis. And then paper number three was published in the Journal of Analytical Psychology. It's called The Self in Analysis. Four is another paper that was published in the Journal of Analytical Psychology, which, if you don't know what that is, it's a sort of major Jungian journal that comes out through London and New York. This one's called Jungian Constructivism and the Value of Uncertainty. These two papers really kind of constitute my sort of theoretical framework for the way I work as a Jungian. And the fifth one is called How Does the Transcendent Function? And your local analyst, Michael Horn, wrote this paper, which is a review of my work and Ann Ulanov's work. Very good, comprehensive paper. And the fifth one, or the sixth, this is the fifth, I guess. Is that right? Five? Six, right. Is an article from a recent New Yorker magazine that I like very much. This is an article on feminism in India, and it's wonderful for making the point of how important personal sovereignty is. It's called Gandhi's Daughters, India's Poorest Women Embark on an Epic Social Experiment. And it's about these women who are organizing. India's government actually now requires, the constitution requires that a third of the public positions be filled by women. And many of the women who are really gaining a major political power in India from the lowest caste, many of them illiterate. It's a quite remarkable article. And the which I don't, it's a recent New Yorker, like, but I think maybe December or something like that. It might be in there, I don't know. I don't know if the New Yorker puts it on the pages. No, I don't think it is. The last one is also from a recent Journal of Analytical Psychology, but it's a response to a really long paper by a woman named Cecile Togas, which is a paper that's a kind of attack on my work, let's say. It's not written entirely that way, but basically Togas takes the position that it's not, that one cannot be a Jungian and be a constructivist or a non-essentialist or whatever, and that there is associated with this way of thinking a kind of despair. And I reply from the perspective of being a Buddhist, and that the this whole way of thinking, if this, again, these terms may not make sense to you, but non-essentialism has a very long tradition in Buddhist philosophy and has nothing to do with despair, but rather with interdependence and the notion that nothing exists separately apart from anything else. And that's really the underlying idea behind the notion of emptiness. So those are the papers. Here's the sign-up sheet. And we'll pass the whole package around today. Oh, also, if you know someone who was there last night and you think, because several people last night asked me about these papers, and if you think that a friend of yours would like a copy, please feel free to sign up for someone else as well. Just pass the whole package around. So now we will begin, and Ed's going to start and introduce himself and talk about his part, and then I'll take it from there.
It's all right, I don't need that. I'll start. My name is Ed Epstein. Professionally, I am a clinical social worker with a private practice in Burlington, Vermont. And Polly, that's my professional part. So
it's hard work, though.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, but it's worth it.
Good.
Oh, we're going to enjoy this day. So private practice, I work mostly with couples and with individuals, mostly with individual men. And I would say the individual men that I work with, maybe a half to three quarters are seeing me because their relationships are in trouble or because their wives want to leave them or have left them. I don't see any women whose husbands are wanting to leave them. It's a phenomenon. The wives are the ones who are in a position of saying that they're calling the kids. And they're generally reeling from it and trying to make some sense of it and to figure out what happened and what can be done. I also work at the Employee Assistance Office of the University of Vermont, where I'm an Employee Assistance Counselor, and I meet with faculty and staff from the university who are having problems of any sort, personal problems or work-related problems. Polly and I work together doing dialogue therapy, which we're going to be talking about today. Talking about dialogue therapy, I'd say more in the second half of the presentation, at which point I will be doing more of the talking than I will be doing in the first part. Polly's going to be doing the lion's share of the first part of the presentation, and I'm saying this because I want it to be clear that this is fine with me. She's not taking over or like not allowing me to talk. I prefer that she does the lion's share of the presenting because she does it so much better than I do that I just love listening to it. And she has a lot more to say. So I just wanted to make sure you understood that. So when you hear her doing most of the talking, you'll know that it's fine with me. I have my own way of talking, and actually, once I get started, it takes me longer to warm up. So, I think that's enough from me for the moment.
Okay.
Okay.
So I'm Polly Young Eisendrath, and I know that a lot of you met me last night, but I'll say a few things about who I am and how I practice, and then about our marriage also, and the kinds of things that we've struggled with. I'm a Jungian analyst in Burlington, Vermont, and I'm also a psychologist and clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the University of Vermont Medical College. And I practice a lot. I practice 35 to 40 hours a week when I'm in Burlington. The poor folks who see me have to miss me for these long periods of time that I go away. But when people actually sort of sign on to work with me, they know that I will go away both for these programs and for meditation retreats, which sometimes are longer than my times to go out to do programs. So in my practice, I do both individual analytical psychotherapy and analysis. In analysis, I see people on the couch, and I see them for 2, 3, or 4 times a week. In the individual therapy, it's face-to-face, and it's once a week. Then Ed and I do dialogue therapy together, and the dialogue therapy appointments are 2 hours each, except for the first meeting, which is 3 hours with a couple. And you'll see that the way that we work with a couple for the... Well, how many people are clinicians? Let me just see that... It's about half, I guess. We're going to use some, at times we're going to throw out some technical terms because we feel like it's a good idea for those people who are clinicians to kind of know that we think about what we're doing. And for other people, sometimes it's enlightening, and if it's confusing, ask us questions. But the kind of couples therapy we do would be known as short-term anxiety-provoking psychotherapy. And that means that we have a time-limited intervention, which is a package of 7 sessions. We meet with the couples for 6 meetings that are once a month, and then we have a 6-month break and we see them once more in a 7th meeting. So that's the overall package for dialogue therapy. Sometimes we vary that package depending on the couple's needs, but by and large we can hold to that framework. We will be talking more about the method itself in the afternoon, and this morning we'll be talking about the process of transformation that a couple goes through. But in all of the work that I do in doing psychotherapy and analysis, the couple's work is probably really at the forefront of my growth and development. And I think it's because when you see a couple, you see a dynamic field in which the unconscious is already operating so strongly, that field is full of the psychological complexes of the two individuals. They wouldn't be coming for therapy, particularly for couples therapy, which people are loath to do, by and large. And people don't come to couples therapy generally for growth and development. They come because they're made to come, usually by the other partner. And often what's happening is that both people are hoping that the therapist will change the other partner. So people aren't coming in hoping for change in themselves in couples therapy. They're coming with hopes to change their partner. So in couples therapy, what you see in this dynamic field between the two individuals is the enactment of psychological complexes in a way that one has to work hard to get in individual therapy. It has to happen through the transference. And for most people, it takes a little while to warm up to the transference. So what I like to say is that in couples therapy, I see more hatred in my consulting room than I see under almost any other conditions ever in my life. You know, people are willing to enact a level of hatred with a partner that they're unwilling to do anywhere else. And it's really quite amazing that that's the case. And all of us, I think, probably recognize, those of us who are in long-term partnerships, how that's true of ourselves as well. How we can reduce ourselves or be reduced to the kind of lowest common denominator in our personalities in relationship to somebody that we supposedly love. So it's a peculiar situation.
Can I say something about
it? Of course.
We just saw a movie on video, which is not a very good movie, but there are a few good lines in it. It's called The Story of Us. I don't know if anybody's ever seen it.
Some people might think it's a good movie.
Well, that's okay.
You said it's not a very good movie.
I didn't think it was a very good movie. Other people might have. There's a line in there where these two guys are talking about their marriages, and one of them is saying there's just so much hate. And the other guy says, don't worry, hate fades.
Right. Eventually, it'll just fade to boredom. Right. So there is something quite difficult about being in a long-term partnership. And by the way, when we talk about marriage today, let's say that in Vermont, we're working hard to establish same-sex marriages. And so when we speak about marriage, we actually mean a long-term couple relationship. But to say that every time, instead of saying marriage, just adds to the length of time we'll be together. So we really do mean same-sex as well as heterosexual relationships. We, in dialogue therapy, we see same-sex couples as well as heterosexual couples. And Vermont, actually, you probably know, is a state that has just changed its constitution to recognize the rights of gays and lesbians in long-term relationships, that their rights would be the same as heterosexual couples. So, about Ed and myself, just a little bit about us. We have been together since 1982 as a couple and started working with couples, actually, in 1982. And we got married then in 85 and have a blended family, two children from my first marriage and one child from his, which we consider to be our children, the three children. I also have a stepson from my first marriage. And so altogether we have, in our extended blended, four children who range in age from 25 to 35, soon to be 26 to 36. Which really is amazing. So we've had all of the struggles with children and exes and stepchildren and other people's stepchildren and so on. And so we ourselves know in our family how these relationships are difficult to manage in a way that continues love over time.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.